leisure activities. It's early afternoon when I arrive in the pretty village of Zena. Before checking into my B&B, I wander around the ancient parish church and immediate surrounding countryside, which, with good reason, has been designated an area of outstanding natural beauty. After what I deem to be a respectable length of time soaking up the atmosphere, I head for the pub. The Tinner's Arms is an attractive, old-fashioned pub where everything seems to be made of wood. I plonk myself on one of the stools, all of which are made from emptied beer barrels, at a small table, and make myself comfortable. I sample their eponymous ale, and am duly impressed. I chat for some time to the friendly landlady and barman about everything from correct tyre pressures to pre-war Scandinavian politicians. As I'm advising them that I've never actually read Women in Love, into the pub arrives the chap walking the coast path for charity, from a few days ago, complete with entourage and the big 630 T-shirts. Inevitably, as the ale flows freely, we all end up pushing our empty barrels together and chatting the evening away, discussing everything from early 80s synth pop to the downfall of MFI. I don't recall the journey back to my B&B with complete clarity, dear reader, but I feel confident it will have been conducted with a quiet and subtle dignity. As I set off along the footpath leading out of Zena to rejoin the coast path early the next morning, the rain is falling hard, the skies are a thunderous dark grey, and the winds are relentless. The 12-mile trip to St. Just is promising to be a tough one. The path picks up where it left off the previous afternoon, with a steep, slippery descent down a rocky hillside to a bridge crossing a small stream. To compound matters further, I've picked up a bit of a head cold, which is definitely slowing me down as I climb back out of the valley under sheets of driving rain. The path continues undulating through the rocky landscape for a brief spell before I'm clambering down into another valley. It continues like this for some time, with the increasingly poor conditions robbing me of any views and ensuring my pace is slow and cumbersome. Even the gulls are absent as I inch along the single-track path with a sheer drop to the raging sea beside me. It would be an ideal moment to bolster the brave explorer motif, but I'm too busy feeling sorry for myself. I continue past Bosigran Head and again climb down, this time to Porthmoyna Cove. It's around here, as I'm mulling over the number of place names in Cornwall that start with either Porth or Tray, that the ghostly remains of mining buildings start to materialise through the mist and rain. Giant, tumbling chimneys and half-standing stone structures that take on an eerie feel, silhouetted against the stormy backdrop. As I pass through these remnants of Cornwall's once thriving industry, the path is constantly splintering off in several directions, with the poor visibility making it increasingly difficult to navigate. Just past the lighthouse at Pendeen, which, to be frank, I can't really see through the rain, I arrive at Geevil Mine. The landscape becomes even more industrial as the building remains are joined by huge slag heaps dotted either side of the path. I then come to Levant Mine, which is owned by the National Trust and has been lovingly restored and opened up to the public. This adds a surreal edge to the day, as through the murky and blustery conditions, families of tourists emerge from a pay-and-display car park. I pass a gift shop and an ice cream van before rounding a corner and being instantly transported back to the remote and stormy isolation of a few minutes prior. I briefly wonder if I've hallucinated the last 100 yards. By the time I reach the third and final mine at Botalic, I'm very nearly spent. The rain has not eased up for a second, and the wind is actually continuing to strengthen. The path again splits like a maze, and the way markers disappear. At some point, I take a wrong turning. I spend an hour or so finding my way back to the coast path. Soon after this, I arrive at a golf course. If I was in a pram and had some toys with me, I would throw those toys out of the pram. If I had a pair of knickers, I would twist them. That is to say, I would get them in a twist, the knickers. Sometime later, I arrive at Cape Cornwall, which, even in these conditions, is arrestingly beautiful. I stop and stare out past the lighthouse to the still raging sea. The rain at last eases slightly, and the distant cries of seabirds are audible for the first time today. I take my pack off and collapse like a drowned rat onto the muddy ground. I spend a few minutes here, transfixed. This gives me the strength to face the final mile or so trek inland to the town of St. Just, where I'm booked into a pub for the evening. I leave the coast path and trudge along first a farm track and then a B road until I eventually reach the town's attractive central market square with its imposing clock tower. After the longest bath in the history of intelligent life, I make my way, shrivelled like a prune, down to the pub for dinner. Conscious that most evening meals up to now have consisted either in part or in total of chips, I decide to splash out on the house speciality. I'm presented with a monkfish curry. Now, I don't know to what extent the trauma of the day behind me is a factor here, but I have to tell you, dear reader, that the commercial inn in the town of St. Just, Cornwall, Great Britain, serves the best monkfish curry in the entire world. Later that evening, I called several loved ones to share this important discovery, but, if anything, I'm met with little more than widespread apathy. I head off early the next morning, brimming with excitement at the prospect of reaching Land's End. Even though Land's End isn't technically half distance, it's very much the psychological halfway point of the trail, the major turning point from which you begin the long journey home. I'm still fighting off a bit of a cold, but have dramatically improved since yesterday in that regard. As has the weather, which has gone from one extreme to the other. As I rejoin the path, just the other side of Cape Cornwall, the sun is illuminating the clear blue skies, and the sea is a calm, shimmering blanket. The gulls and songbirds have emerged from their hiding places and now fill the sky both physically and audibly. The going is relatively flat and easy as I push, on overlooking splendid rocky and sandy beaches. The sun is beating down, and I'm conscious of not applying adequate quantities of the trusted Factor 30 before setting off this morning. I can feel the beginnings of the burn on my face. I squint up at the sky and see the silhouette of a kestrel flying alongside me just over the hillside. It glides mesmerisingly, rising and falling as I smile up at it adoringly. I imagine it following me round the entire trail to Poole Harbour and dream up a lengthy canon of exciting adventures for the two of us. Incredible, life-affirming stories which reveal the unbreakable bond between a handsome wanderer and his wild hunter bird, tamed only by its unwavering respect and loyalty towards this mysterious man of nature. I would stand atop the cliffs, calling to it. I could speak kestrel, obviously. The camera would pan out as the bird swoops down from nowhere and perches on my shoulder. I will name it Kestwing. That needs work. When I reach Land's End a few hours later, the day is still a fine and clear one. Although a stiff breeze now chills the bones, it's difficult to know where to start when attempting to describe Land's End. The isolation and tranquillity of the Cornish coastline are replaced with a sort of mini fun fair and hotel complex that might be better suited to Bognor Seafront. What the place lacks in beauty, it more than compensates for in weirdness. So effectively has this picturesque and significant patch of Cornwall been transformed into a bizarre neon wonderland that it almost defies parody. The smell of frying burgers, cigarette smoke and sticky candy floss fill the air as I wander through the end of the world. I pass limp rotating hot dogs and people in their pyjamas, past screaming parents and their defiant spawn, past dilapidated kiosks and, hang on, slush puppies. Best day ever. What a truly wonderful and magical place this is. I order an extra large raspberry slush and excitedly carry the glowing bright blue cup of goodness through the crowds and out towards a small cafe by the cliff edge. The cafe has a sign that reads, "The first and last refreshments house in England." I sling off the pack and sit on a bench in front of the sign to consume my ample beverage. I give myself a few minutes to reflect on the adventure so far and everything that's still to come. Once the ego is suitably massaged, the aching feet suitably rested, and the belly suitably bloated with a pint of blue slush, I don the pack and carry on. After a few yards, I spy the famous Land's End sign that every visitor is obliged to get a photograph of themselves standing in front of. It displays distances to John O'Groats, New York, and the Isles of Scilly. As I approach it, however, it becomes clear that the aforementioned souvenir snap won't be quite so simple. There is a long queue of people and a sandwich board that advises me it will cost me £18 to have my photograph taken in front of the sign. That's £18 for one photograph of me standing in front of a sign. For this paltry sum, you do, of course, also get a fourth distance marker added to the sign displaying a destination of your choice. This is of no interest to yours truly, and so I sidle up to the small waist-height fence that encircles the famous landmark, turn my back to it, smile my best smile, and take a picture with my phone for free. As I continue on my way, I give a pitying look to the chumps still standing in the queue and take a gander at my photograph. What I see smiling back at me alarms me. A bright red, sunburnt face, save for the brilliant white of the crow's feet around my eyes, and bright blue lips. Oh, and a blurry sign in the background telling me how far it is to West Bromwich from here. Underneath the sign stands a rotund, angry-looking man holding a camera. I use the public facilities to wash the blue from my mouth and plaster on the Factor 30. I then sneak back and take another picture, with marginally better results. I pick up the path again and leave Land's End behind me. On my way, I pass a small petting zoo as a couple of grubby preschoolers with trainers fitted with glowing LED lights throw crisps at some thoroughly miserable-looking goats. As the path begins to get more interesting, the people start to disappear, and the distant hue and cry of the crowd fades away. Looking back, I see the impressive armed Night Rock sticking out into the sea with a giant hole through its centre. The walking remains easy as I stick to a hilltop path near the cliff edge. The rocky beaches of Zorn Trevilly and then Mill Bay pass by in the hot afternoon sunshine. Silky waves lap on the sandy shoreline below as noisy gulls glide and swoop across the clear skies above. I'm soon descending into the quintessential Cornish village of Porthgwarra, where I take a moment to rest the feet by sprawling out on the sand. It turns out that a tasty extra-large slush puppy is not a sensible midday beverage when embarking on a 12-mile hike. Who knew? I'm still belching freely as I clamber to my feet 10 minutes later and lumber on. Later that afternoon, after passing the secluded Porth Chapel beach, I am nearing the end of the day's walk. The path leads me into a car park belonging to the Meinach Theatre in Porth Curnow. Not being the most cultured of fellows, my knowledge of the Meinach is limited. I have, though, been led to believe that it's a sight to behold. It's therefore with some enthusiasm that I make my sweaty way to the theatre entrance. After paying my ticket fee and convincing the rosy-cheeked lady at reception that she really does want to look after my bag whilst I wander round, regardless of standard procedure, I turn the corner and see the theatre in front of me. Blimey. The open-air theatre is carved into the rock face and juts triumphantly out from the cliff edge. I'm dumbstruck at its splendour, feeling as though I've wandered into ancient Rome by mistake. A sensation supported by the Mediterranean-like blue sea, providing a sparkling backdrop in the still, warm sunlight. I expect to see a couple of gladiators appear and fight it out to the death at any moment. It occurs to me that in the space of just a few hours, I've seen the very worst and very best examples of humankind's effects on this exhilarating coastline. The tacky entertainment complexes of Land's End seem of a different world to the architectural triumph that now caresses my optic senses. Caresses my optic senses? What on earth? I'm trying to be theatrical. The theatre is the brainchild of the late Rowena Cade, who started building it in the late 1920s and never really stopped. There is a fascinating museum on site that details the history of this ever-evolving masterpiece. I'm also lucky enough to be here as a rehearsal is taking place, and so get to experience something of what it would be like to watch a performance here. I can only imagine how wonderful it must be in the evening light with a full crowd. I sit contentedly for a good 30 minutes before making my way to the cafe, where I sit contentedly for a further 30 minutes. I vow to return here one day to watch a full production. In the end, I begrudgingly tear myself away from the Minac and head for the B&B I'm booked into for the night. During the trip thus far, I've more often than not plumped for a room above a pub ahead of a B&B. Tonight's lodgings adequately sum up the reasons behind this decision. Don't get me wrong, the house is perfectly lovely and its owner perfectly pleasant. A tip-top chap, in fact. But when all is said and done, I'm sleeping in a stranger's spare room. For some, more socially accomplished members of the rambling jet set, this is all part of the charm of long-distance walking. Who wants to be in a smelly, impersonal room above a pub when you could be relaxing with new friends in the comfort of their living room? Sharing life stories over a home-cooked meal before retiring to your snug bedroom where, later that night, your new best friend will bludgeon you to death with the delightful Art Deco-style doorstop you were waxing lyrical about over your home-cooked lentil moussaka. Breakfast the next morning is a communal affair. Myself and the two other guests staying in the house, a young couple looking every bit as uncomfortable as I feel, are positioned around a circular dining table in the kitchen, along with our earnest host. Apart from a brief encounter with the owner the previous evening, this is the first time I've met any of my dining companions. I spent the night in the local pub nursing an ale or two before creeping back to my room in the dead of night. Luckily, being a 21st-century office worker, I have endured many years of awkward, joyless, getting-to-know-you sessions and team-building days, and so I'm fully equipped to deal with this situation. I'm able to recite any number of inane questions from a large, memorised supply. Once we've rolled through the full set of introductory platitudes and are tucking into our full English, we begin to relax. The couple are on a holiday with no plan. That is to say, they have literally got in the car and headed to Cornwall with no idea where they would stay or what they would do. I exclaim my delight at this, as does our increasingly jovial host. "Do you do that a lot?" I inquire. "First time. We've only been together a couple of months, so this is our first holiday." I reflect on how the impulsiveness of love's young dream can, on occasion, lead you to be sat in someone else's kitchen at 7:30 in the morning with only a sunburnt rambler and a moussaka-making, doorstop-wielding murderer for company. I march off towards the sea to pick up the path a short while later, full of joie de vivre and fried stuff. A steady climb takes me out of Porthcurno, up above the sandy beaches, to reveal the path ahead of me. It's another glorious spring day as I pass the impressively scaly Logan Rock. Rowley advises me that a pair of cohabiting giants are thought to live here. But they must be out enjoying the sunshine, as the rock stands deserted amongst the motionless surface of the water. A series of steep descents and ascents follow, as the path climbs to hilltops with beautiful panoramic views and then drops just as suddenly down into unspoiled coves with rows of empty wooden fishing boats. I enter a luscious green woodland section as my ears ring with the sound of hundreds of merrily chirping birds nestled in the trees all around me. A few yards in, my progress is halted as a young fox wanders onto the path about 30 feet ahead of me. I stand, statuesque, and observe as it sits and cleans its paws, completely unaware of my presence. I silently and somewhat stealthily manoeuvre my phone from my pocket. I switch it to camera and very slowly position it to face the still oblivious creature. My finger is over the button as the fox glances up, sees me, and scarpers into the bushes. I get a photo of a woodland track with a small orange blur in one corner. I'm experiencing so many scenes like this, private glimpses of all manner of wildlife that I could not otherwise get to observe. From leaping deer to fearless squirrels that fly kamikaze from branch to branch, whether it be a buzzard taking a nap in the long grass of a farmland field, or a baby rabbit tentatively exploring its new surroundings. Unique moments which all serve to further enrich this incredible trail. I emerge from the trees into a stunningly beautiful cove. Rowley is unable to confirm with any certainty whether it's St. Loy's or Painter's Cove. He really needs to buck his ideas up. I cross the pebbly beach and weave through a small spattering of two or three houses. The spot is so secluded and has an almost tropical feel to it, contrasted against the rocky cliffs and the still, calm ocean. I decide that once I've replaced Bill Bryson as the world's premier travel writer and made my inevitable millions, I will live here. I'll probably just buy all the houses so I can have a spare or two for guests. The sharp climbs and precarious descents continue as the day wears on. It doesn't take long before they start to take their toll, and I'm exhausted. My pack is weighing heavy and my feet are throbbing. It's the downhill sections that are causing me the most issues. The concentration required to balance the weight of the pack whilst gingerly descending through jagged rocks on slippery muddy paths along a cliff edge where tripping isn't an option is increasingly difficult to maintain. After a while I'm given some respite, however, as the path levels out in the approach to Kemuel Point. Another rise follows towards Point Spaniard, which takes its name from the Anglo-Spanish War, when a fleet of Spanish ships landed here and subsequently laid carnage to the nearby Penzance. The since-rebuilt Penzance is where my day's walk ends. But first I must negotiate New Lynn and the excellently named Mousel, both of which turn out to be unwelcome urban sprawls. To be clear, as I'm aware that anyone who's visited either of these spots and is reading this is no doubt wondering what on earth I'm talking about, both spots are, in the grand scheme of things, quaint and picturesque Cornish villages or towns. But when you spend all day in the comparative wilderness, marvelling at the wonders of nature, any sudden accumulation of concrete, car engines and retail outlets is sure to be an unwelcome sight. I feel certain that if I was to revisit any one of the coastal settlements that I've callously dismissed, albeit with unsurpassed wit and sophistication, I would find them a welcome and peaceful retreat from city life. It's all context. The context here being that my feet hurt, my pack is slowly but surely remoulding my spine, and I'm sweaty and clammy in a way that is as unpleasant as it is unhygienic. Maintaining the generous spirit of the previous paragraph, I'll put my initial opinion of Penzance down to context. Likewise, the pub that I've booked a suspiciously cheap room above. I mean, I enjoy the comfort of the tracksuit bottom as much as the next man, but statistically speaking, what are the chances of this being the chosen attire of an entire pub full of patrons? Perhaps there's a leisure wear convention in town that I'm unaware of. My room is dark, stained and, most alarmingly of all, hairy. The latter to such a degree that I decide that when the time comes, I'll unravel the old sleeping bag rather than peel back the suspect sheets. At least that way I know the source of the stains and hairs on which I lay. That evening, I dine on an all-you-can-eat Chinese buffet and spend a pleasant couple of hours talking to friends and family on the phone. The 14-mile hike to Porthleven the following day begins bright and early with a stroll along the promenade out of Penzance. The walkway is the only thing separating the railway track on one side from the boisterous sea on the other, which makes for a bracing start to the walk. I'm soon passing St. Michael's Mount, an elaborate castle on its own tiny island, accessible only at low tide. A short jaunt through the town of Marazion follows, but is mercifully short, if somewhat confusing. Just as I'm starting to think I might be lost, I find my way back to the beach, and eventually a path leading back up onto the Cornish cliffs. The going is generally easy along the next stretch, but is not lacking in dramatic views as the sea below begins to work up a temper. There is an inland diversion due to cliff erosion to negotiate for a few miles. This takes me along a country lane, past a quintessentially English village and over some open farmland before returning me to the coast. The landscape stretching out in front of and behind me is a contrast of blooming flowers, sandy beaches, jagged rocks, and now raging waves. The wind is strong, and the looming clouds above threaten to erupt at any moment. Countless gliding gulls and crows are silhouetted against the horizon to complete the richness of the scene. I'm again conscious that there is nowhere on earth that I would rather be right now. I walk across the large sandy beach at Perenufno and onwards to Piskey's Cove, a baffling oasis of calm, tranquil blue waters, before then reaching the astonishing Prussia Cove, a truly beautiful landscape with a rich history of smuggling and shipwrecks. The path here winds through isolated homes perched on the cliff edge, then past an eerie collection of ghostly, dilapidated fishermen's cottages left to ruin. The walking continues to be relatively untaxing as I pass Kenegi Sands, round Ho Point, and arrive at Prah Sands, a vast, sprawling, sandy beach full of revelling surfers. There is a beachside bar and restaurant that tantalisingly tempts me as I plonk myself unceremoniously down on the sand to consume my lunch rations. My food supplies have again reached a sorrowful state of affairs. My remaining 3 Mars bars have melted down and then been reborn as new, deformed and unappetising shapes. My processed spicy sausage snacks are, well, still processed spicy sausage snacks. Those glorious early lunches of swanky French salamis and handy bite-sized cheeses seem but a distant dream. As I sit munching, the rain begins to drizzle down and forces me to cut short my lamenting. I trudge cumbersomely through the loose sand underfoot for what seems like an age before finally rejoining the path proper. I walk through a scrubland area called Lessive, which brings with it the re-emergence of reminders of Cornwall's rich mining history. Piles of slag and the ruins of great chimneys once more appear around me. Frustratingly, the path takes me slightly inland again over the next section, avoiding more coastal erosion, no doubt. I can see more ruined mining buildings practically hanging from the dramatic rocky cliff edges above the crashing waves. I want to be closer to the cliff edge and begrudge this safety-based diversion decision. Eventually, as Porthleven comes into view, the path at last returns to the coastline. The threatening downpour never emerged, and the clouds have now given way to clear blue skies. The wind still packs a punch, and the waves below still crash atmospherically, but the scene is more sedate as I continue on my way. As if to verify this assertion, scores of busy rabbits have appeared from nowhere and are grazing merrily in the fields to my left. I spy a grass snake on the path in front of me and stop still to watch as it slithers by. On the way into Porthleven, 2 unaccompanied dogs appear over the hillside. A black Labrador and a small terrier of some description run towards me, give me a ruddy good sniff, and then continue on about their business, which seems to primarily consist of pawing and barking at rabbit holes. I look about for the owners, but none appear. I wait around for 5 minutes to put my mind at rest, but still nobody arrives. The pair are excitedly running about the place without a care in the world, paying me no attention whatsoever. Yet they are at times precariously close to the cliff edge, and I decide that I can't, in all good conscience, just walk away. I take off my pack and walk over to them to see if they have collars on, but neither do. I glance at my phone and I see I have no reception. I try to get them to follow me by offering them a spicy sausage snack. They decline, which must surely say something regards my current luncheon menu. I walk inland, onto the nearest road, and continue along it for some time before I come across a man washing his car outside a red brick bungalow. "Excuse me, sorry to trouble you," I say. "I'm a little worried, as there's a couple of dogs back down the road that I think might be strays. Would you be able to help at all?" He looks me up and down and smiles. "A black lab and a Yorkie? Yes, that's them. They belong to the house up the hill," he says, pointing off at nothing. "They spend their lives there. Nothing to worry about. I mean, it's not much of a story, dear reader, but it was a roller coaster of emotions at the time, I assure you." Porthleven is an attractive harbour town with an imposing clock tower that sticks defiantly out to sea. It's reminiscent of Padstow, with its trendy upmarket restaurants and pubs. It appeals to me more than the former, though, for reasons I'm not sure of. Possibly it's not quite as overdeveloped, and perhaps something in its layout is more attractive. I'm staying in a friendly guest house at the top of one of the sides of the valley that the town sits in. From outside, I can look down over the small, bustling town centre and out to sea. This is a particularly pretty sight after sunset, when the entire town is illuminated by hundreds of hanging, multicoloured lights. I spend that evening in a very pleasant pub near the seafront. I plump for an ale aptly titled Porthleven, courtesy of a local brewery based in nearby Truro. It's a contender for the best of the trip so far. After one or two, I get chatting to a chap at the bar. He's possibly in his 60s, has bushy grey sideburns, and is wearing a slightly shabby green sweatshirt that is a smidge on the small side for his generous frame. He is Porthleven born and bred, and weaves an engrossing tale, charting the history of the place and how much it's changed in his lifetime. Among many points of interest, he tells me that the impressive clock tower is currently a snooker club venue. I find this somewhat depressing, but he points out that it's better than it sitting empty. Eventually, we get chatting about my journey, and he clearly struggles to understand my reasons for attempting it. So you're telling me that you're walking all of the Cornwall Coast Path on your own? No, I'm walking all of the South West Coast Path on my own, Minehead round to Poole Harbour. He looks at me as though he's trying to decide whether or not I'm pulling his leg. He takes another swig of beer before asking, "Why?" "It's just something I've wanted to do for a long time, you know, for fun." He takes this in. "'Cause it's this you got to be wary of, son." He taps his temple with his forefinger. "All that time, with only your own thoughts for company. It's a long old road." I sense we're in danger of getting a bit philosophical and steer the conversation in a different direction. We discuss the best ales I've tried along the way, and he's delighted that the one we're both currently enjoying rates so highly in my estimation. At the end of the evening, we say our goodbyes, and he wishes me luck for the rest of the trip. "Well, I won't pretend I don't think you're as nuts as a bag of nuts." He actually said that. "But I say good on you." Later that night, I'm struggling to fall asleep, and my mind eventually wanders back to his words. "All that time with only your own thoughts for company. What if he's right? What if this trip drives me crazy? What if I can't integrate back into normal society? What if I've spent the last 25 days talking to my guidebook? What if there is no grey sideburned man sitting at the bar? What if I go back there tomorrow and ask after him and I'm told, 'You must mean old Jacob. But he'd been dead these past 30 years. What if I am as nuts as a bag of nuts?" Early the next morning, I'm climbing out of Porthleven at the beginning of the day's 14-mile slog to the Lizard, the most southwesterly point of mainland Britain. The wind is ferocious, and the sky filled with hundreds of noisy gulls. Early on, I spy two of them squabbling with a kestrel or a peregrine. I'm never sure which at a distance. The scene is like watching a First World War dogfight, as the three skilled flyers weave and dive at each other, before the gulls are inevitably victorious and chase the other away. Despite the blustery conditions, the sun is warm and bright as the sky and ocean compete over which is the more vivid tone of blue. After an easy flat section along the hilltops, I reach the Loo Bar. The area is designated one of outstanding natural beauty, and is not difficult to see why. The bar itself is a giant sandbank created by raging storms in the 12th century. As it formed, it cut off the estuary behind it from the sea. This created Loo Pool, the largest freshwater lake in the county. Beautiful it may be, but it's not pleasant walking after a while. A long stretch of loose sand that soon becomes a real slog in the strong winds. Thankfully, I eventually climb back up to the cliff top, where the path remains flat and unusually straight, until I reach a cove called Gunwallow a few miles later. The path becomes a touch more challenging from then on in, but it's still a good deal less eventful than the average day's walking on this trail. I'm not complaining, however, as the wind has died down and the summer scenery is a joy to stroll through. The pretty but overpopulated Church Cove follows, before I reach a striking monument on the way to Mullion. It's titled the Marconi Monument and marks the spot where Guglielmo Marconi sent the first transatlantic radio signal in 1901. The crowds enjoying Church Cove and visiting the monument continue as I arrive at the day's halfway point of Mullion Cove. I stop for lunch and a milkshake, which I purchased earlier from a small beach cafe. As I'm sitting, supping contentedly, an elderly gent slips on the serpentine rocks in front of me. He lands head first and splits his nose open with gory results. I rush over to him, but his wife and several other passers-by already surround him. After recovering from the shock and resting a while, he seems okay, but it won't look pretty for a good while. This area has an abundance of serpentine, which is startlingly pretty rock, but a very slippery one. I do genuinely, therefore, question the sense of having stiles made from the material throughout the section of the coast path. The things are deadly, and on many occasions I've nearly gone arse about face. The next few miles take me through an area called Pradanoc Downs, a landscape that feels totally different to any I've walked through recently. Large, open, grassy, rolling expanses, staying at a consistent level as far as the eye can see. This featureless landscape provides me with an excellent opportunity to work on my album of walking-themed classics. I've been composing this masterpiece, mentally, for a week or so now. The premise is simple enough. Take a well-known song from the popular music world and change a word or two so that it sounds like it's about walking. I'll give you an example. You know the PJ and Duncan classic, Let's Get Ready to Rumble? Of course you do. Well, I changed it to Let's Get Ready Ramble. Sing it to yourself. It's good, eh? More recently, I've come up with Keep Strolling, 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 you know, like the song that says Keep Rolling, 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 Rolling by Linford Biscuits or whatever he's called. It's a surefire money spinner in the unlikely event that this book doesn't make me my billions. It's always sensible in life to have a robust backup plan. The path continues in a similar vein until I eventually reach the beautiful chaos that is Kynance Cove. A striking, if ramshackle, collection of jagged cliffs, rocky islands, caves and such like. Rowley advises me that one of these islands is named Asparagus Island, but I'm hanged if I can tell you which one. It's impossible not to pause for thought here and watch as the sea crashes in amongst this maze-like jumble. I push on past a small collection of cottages and out towards Lizard Point. My final destination is a campsite a few miles inland, as I feel it's time the canvas got another outing. The remainder of the walk continues to be relatively flat, and when I reach the campsite, I'm astonished at my lack of tiredness. I set up camp and head off to Lizard Village to find a chippy. The village has an oddly sparse feeling to it, as the buildings are situated at great distances from each other, which gives the whole place a remote Father Ted feel. After sitting in the evening light, eating a bag of chips and looking out at the sea for a while, I make my way back to the tent. It's a surprisingly welcome sight. This is a great spot for camping, and I'm feeling as though I might be discovering the outdoors man in me at last. Stupid tent. I mean, what's the point? It's the following morning, and I've had 3 hours and 27 minutes of sleep, most of which was spent dreaming of erecting an impossible giant tent, assembling endless poles and hooks, and never achieving anything resembling a usable structure. Now, here I am, aching, hungry, and distinctly dishevelled, trying in vain to pack the blasted thing back into the appropriate bags, which have all, definitely and without any question, shrunk during the night. Well, this is it, Mr. Tent. Our sham of a relationship is over. I'll carry you around, but from now on, you are dead weight to me. I have plenty more to say to Mr. Tent, but to stop myself, deciding that maintaining a relationship with one inanimate object is probably enough. After achieving the impossible and reassembling the kit, I'm on my way again, and the going is initially easy. The lush green hillsides, dotted with blooming flowers in the morning sunlight, and a chorus of cheery birdsong, all serve to brighten my mood considerably. I'm not far into the trek, however, when the drops and climbs begin. I pause for breath at the conclusion of the third or fourth steep ascent and consult Rowley regards the day ahead. He advises that this stretch is brimming with basking sharks and I should be able to catch sight of one before long. This is exciting news and there's a spring in the step as I continue on my way. The walk continues to be challenging over the next few miles. The task is made all the more difficult by the continued abundance of attractive but slippery serpentine stiles. By the time I reach Cadgwith, I'm exhausted and decide that an early lunch is in order. I sit watching the numerous boats of varying sizes and descriptions perched on the gently rocking sea. With a start, I realise I have company in the form of a deceased frog sitting centimetres in front of me, gazing lifelessly at my half-consumed chocolatey rations. This is the third such departed amphibian I've observed in the last 24 hours. I hope this isn't the beginnings of a biblical plague or deadly killer virus that wipes out all life on Earth. First, the frogs started dying. Then the budgerigars, that sort of thing. As I leave Cadgwith, a light rain shower wakens the gulls' interest, and the bird song of earlier is replaced by a sustained period of squawks and cries from these characterful seabirds. I pass large numbers of wild ponies over the next few miles, all contentedly munching on the plentiful flora. One decidedly rotund Shetland follows me along the path for a while, sniffing at my backpack, before eventually deciding that nothing of interest lay within. The walk has flattened out since lunch, and despite the intermittent showers, the ambience is that of a serene summertime stroll. I arrive at the Devil's Frying Pan, a once majestic cave whose roof has at some point collapsed, creating an even more impressive arch surrounding a gigantic hole. Even in the relative calm, the sea water froths angrily around as it's temporarily cut off from the ocean. I can only imagine how incredible this spot must be on a fiercely stormy day. I stay staring, utterly transfixed by the scene. I've already passed a devil's mouth at some point recently and am wondering how many other satanic-themed coastal spots I may have missed along the way. It's evidence of the fear generated by the power and potential devastation of the mighty sea. The most beautiful thing on this planet is also a merciless killer. A short while later, I reach a steep climb that takes me to Beagle's Point. Here, I'm met with a truly spectacular view of the path ahead of me, including my destination for the day, Coverack. In light of the latest unpleasant night under the canvas, I have booked a room above a pub that sits just off the path itself, the enticingly named Paris Hotel, which sounds like the perfect antidote to the camping experience. Indeed, whilst admittedly not being quite as grand as the name suggests, the pub does not disappoint. A friendly, welcoming spot and a decent room with a perfect view of the ocean. That evening, I'm lying in bed, watching a constant stream of gulls gliding past my window. It strikes me just how much of this journey so far I've spent looking up. I've come to understand that there's always a drama being played out above our heads. Most of the time, we don't think to look upwards. But we should do. There is a whole other world unfolding just outside of our view. Those gulls are always up to something. Chapter 3. South Cornwall. Ferry crossings. We need to talk about Rowley and stranded in Plymouth. The next day, for reasons I'm unsure of, I set myself the mammoth task of a 23-mile hike to Falmouth, including a ferry crossing over the Helford Estuary. So it's unfathomably early in the morning when I set off from Coverack, leaving the Paris Hotel behind me, and accompanied by a noisy army of gulls, I march purposefully onwards in the bright light of the crisp new day. The gulls swoop around me as if investigating what on earth I'm doing here at this time of the morning. Rowley advises me that much of the going today will be sedate and easy, so I exude something of a ruddy-faced confidence as I make my way onwards. Indeed, as if to confirm this, the day begins without the customary climb out of the village up onto the clifftops. Instead, I leave Coverack on a path that is only just above sea level and is flat and easy going. The sea, dappled with light from above, gently laps at the shoreline, just a few feet below me. A short while later, and the heathland-style surroundings slowly morph into the, by now familiar, signs of industrial mining. This time, however, I'm entering a stretch where the industry is still very much thriving. Gone are the atmospheric ruins of chimneys and abandoned caves, replaced now by the mechanical sights and sounds of a working quarry. The path is still relatively level, and I'm making good early progress. Before long, I've reached the beach belonging to the hamlet of Porthoustock. The otherwise picturesque and typical Cornish beach is completely dominated by a giant concrete stone mill, a vast Orwellian rectangle that renders it completely impossible to notice anything else in the surrounding area. One of those structures that is so hideous and looming that it almost becomes beautiful, although not quite in this case. I now undertake the first steep climb of the day, in order to leave Porthoustock and begin an inland section of walking that Rowley says will last the next few miles. I follow this diversion across farmland and up country lanes, before catching the very welcome sight of the sea again, as I approach Porthallow. Porthallow is an old and pretty fishing village, without any noticeable giant dystopian monstrosities. Apparently, there is a rich history of pilchard fishing in this area, and the village is home to a highly recommended pub that contains many relics from this bygone era. Had I not still got so far to travel today, I would doubtless stick my head around the door for a quick gander and maybe a little something to quench the old thirst. Alas, not today. As I reach Nair Point, the views in front of me open up, and I'm struck by the difference in scenery to that of the previous days and weeks. The rocky cliffs and turquoise, last time I promise you. Seas of North Cornwall now seem as far away as the wind-swept isolation of North Devon and Exmoor. A lush green landscape of rich woodlands and blooming flowers stretches off into infinity ahead of me. The sea has changed too. The surface have been replaced by sailboats, and bright blues and turquoises, by a rich, summery, pale blue blanket of water. How much of this is down to the changing of the season, I don't know, but the difference only serves to enrich the overall experience of walking this wondrous coastline. I pass through the subtropical splendour of the Gillian Estuary, as the path returns to the lazy gentility of earlier in the day. It winds in and out of thick woodland sections, giving glimpses of a distant lighthouse ahead. I come to a beautiful and intensely peaceful spot at St. Anthony in Meneague, a tiny fishing cove with a disproportionate but splendid Norman church. A little while later, as the Helford estuary nears, I stop for lunch in the warmth of the midday sun. After finishing off the good old processed spicy sausage snack, I reach into the pocket of my bag, which contains therein my stash of sacred Mars bars, only to find it empty. I look down at the dried mud, dust and sweat that covers my increasingly loose-fitting clothing. I decide there and then that a third rest wash day is in order tomorrow in Falmouth. I'm the master of my own destiny, dear reader. Never let it be said otherwise. An hour or so later, I arrive at the crossing point along the estuary. I join a small rabble of folks awaiting the Helford ferry, which is actually a small fishing boat with the word ferry written on it in big letters. I clamber aboard, with my backpack again taking up an additional space to the delight of all concerned, The lack of eye contact from any of my fellow passengers adds further credence to my excellent plan regards finding a laundrette as soon as possible. The crossing is calm and serene, gently winding in and out of floating, lifeless sailboats. The walk back along the other side of the estuary is more of the same gentle stroll through rich green woodlands. Indeed, the track continues to meander through the trees and across the occasional stretch of open farmland or secluded cove all the way to Meanporth. During this stretch, I pass through the famous Treba Beach, where the Americans set off for Omaha Beach in Normandy in July 1944. I also enjoy some excellent views in both directions around Rosmullion Head. It's around Meanporth that I meet a group of three women out for a day's hike. We walk together for a short while and swap a few stories. They are walking the 10 miles from Helford to Falmouth and are shocked to hear of my 23-mile jaunt. I say shocked rather than impressed, as I do detect an undercurrent of disapproval. Indeed, a conclusion I'm reaching for myself is that any walk along this coast of longer than about 16 miles is a bit of a wasted day. You're going to miss a good deal and impress nobody. That being said, I do point out in my defence that it has been an unusually easy-going day thus far. I also take the opportunity to ask them about basking sharks and, more specifically, why I haven't seen any yet. They have no answer for me, and put further strain on our fledgling relationship by proclaiming their astonishment at hearing that I've only got one confirmed seal sighting. Some while later, the imposing sight of Pendennis Castle comes into view. A spectacular sight it is too, standing triumphant against the clear blue sky atop the cliffs. It remains in view as I continue on my way past Gillingvay's Beach, Swanpool Nature Reserve, and then on to Pendennis Point. I test my recent theory, vis-à-vis the constant unfolding drama playing out above us, and look upwards. Sure enough, through the blinding sunlight, scores of gulls are swooping and criss-crossing each other at speed. It looks like a well-choreographed and painstakingly rehearsed performance as they survey all below them at a breakneck pace. I'm conscious of entering a section of coastline where sightings of birds of prey, such as the graceful buzzards and hovering kestrels, may be few and far between when compared with recent weeks. This is surely in part due to the increased numbers of people inhabiting the affluent south coast. Yet my spirits are brightened by the idea that this will also mean increased numbers of gulls in search of whatever morsels we, the most wasteful of the species, may discard. The character of these birds endears itself to me more with each passing day. As I finally make the long haul into Falmouth, my feet are screaming at me once again. This apart, however, I'm in pretty good shape, and am still capable of taking in the picturesque bustle of the harbour town. Hundreds of sailboats and yachts fill the harbour side as crowds of holidaymakers and residents contentedly browse the narrow streets. I have again plumped for a hotel geared towards the party pensioners' market, which again proves fruitful, as I pick up a single room for 2 nights overlooking the sea at a bargain basement price. All I have to do is look unabashed at the questioning glances of the hotel staff, which, to be honest with you, I'm not finding to be a problem. That evening, I take a trip to the cinema to watch the Eddie the Eagle Edwards biopic. When he said that he wanted to ski jump in the Olympics, they laughed at him. An impossible task, they said. His plucky heroism and gritty determination led him on a life-changing journey of discovery and ultimate success in the face of adversity. Sure, his scores may not have been as strong as those of his competitors, but he did it. I mean, come on, reader, the similarities are staring you in the face here. I'm saying I'm an unlikely and lovable hero, a national treasure. I'm thinking Ryan Gosling will probably play me in the biopic. The voice of Stephen Fry, could be Rowley, writes itself. I won't bore you with a detailed account of my third rest day, but there are a few points worthy of note before we continue. Compede, remember that? Well, according to numerous reviews on the internet, it is every bit as effective as I was advised. But upon finding some, I decided I'm too tight to pay for it. Feet be damned. Therefore, it's off the table, so you can forget it again. Apologies to my breakfast companion back in Crackington Haven. Also, apparently, I've missed the statue that marks the halfway point of the whole southwest coast path at some point over the last few days. It's as big as me, and is sat right on the path itself. And I walked past it, completely oblivious. Other than that, I rejuvenate the attire and stock up on supplies, then spend the rest of the day wishing I was back out on the trail again. Oh, and Roly 2 is dead. Long live Roly 3. I say a few words and leave him in the bin of my hotel room. It's all very emotional. The following morning begins with two ferry crossings in quick succession. The first from Falmouth to St. Mawes, and then a shorter one across to Place, which leads on to St. Anthony's Head. The experience is completely successful in terms of ridding me of any lingering enjoyment regards the novelty of river crossings, on account of me being a brave Indiana Jones, Eddie the Eagle-type hero figure. I decide I don't need to trouble myself with such trifling trivialities as ferry crossing timetables. Roughly translated, I spend hours standing waiting for the blasted ferries and don't reach Place until it's nearly lunchtime, with the whole day's walk still ahead of me. Undeterred by this shambolic start, I walk on past St. Anthony's Head Lighthouse, an impressive, brilliant white structure that was erected to warn ships of the dangers of the Manacles Rocks, some way offshore, but vastly more important to anyone of my generation for being the lighthouse that features in the opening credits of Fraggle Rock. The path continues its easy-going sprawl of the previous day, but Roly advises me it will get a good deal tougher before the day is done. The clear, warm weather of the previous few days also continues unchanged as the calm, sleepy sea sparkles below me. What is different, however, is the endless stream of people, not just in the countless sailboats out at sea, but everywhere. The path is heaving with them. It's a bank holiday Monday, and as a result, I'm sharing the trail with more people in any given one-hour period than I've encountered on the whole trip thus far. This continues past the positively rammed Towan Beach and onto the village of Porthscalfo. I consider stopping for lunch here, but then remember that I will shortly pass the infamous Hidden Hut, a restaurant in a small hut, specialising in fresh fish and situated on the path itself, at which Pops has eaten in the past and insists I visit on my way through. Eventually, when I do find it, there is a queue of people a mile long. Turns out it's more famous than infamous. I take a peek at the menu board to discover that they've run out of fish and are now only serving cups of soup at £5 a time. I've been exceptionally lucky with my timing on this trip so far, but today is definitely going some way to undoing that. I regrettably carry on past the hut without partaking of any culinary delights. I continue past the equally crowded Pendower Beach and on to Nair Head. The crowds finally thin a touch here as the path gets slightly more challenging. The next stretch between Nair Head and Port Lowe contains several ups and downs that tire me out, but ultimately put a smile back on my face after what has been a cumbersome day. From Port Lowe, I must take a walk inland to my destination for the night, the village of Verian. The prices in Port Lowe are way above my budget, which I'm thinking I may find happening more and more now, as I've hit both the start of the summer season and the affluent south coast at the same time. So I'm in a small B&B in Verian, which is a very pretty village with two distinctive round houses at its centre. These circular cottages were built by a religious family to protect the village from the devil, as there would be no corners for him to hide in. The owners of the B&B are incredibly friendly and welcoming. I put aside all thoughts of our deco door stops in the dead of night and take a shower and relax for a while in my room. Later that evening, I amble over to the village pub for dinner. I'm a good few miles off the path, and the pub is different to any I've frequented up until now. It's an actual village pub, with a few locals propping up the bar and a pleasingly simple food menu. Everyone knows each other. And after the busy bank holiday walking of earlier, it's exactly what I need. Once the chips and a pint of ale have been dispatched, I call the folks and then Tasha. She is standing in the up